Državni izpitni center.
Splošna matura 2014.
Preverjanje slušnega razumevanja.
Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje maturitetne izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine.
Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak.
Rešitve, ki jih pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom, vpisujte v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami.
Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha.
Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear a recording about an expedition to Antarctica. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Now, no one really knows what it would be like to live on Mars, but our next guest has more of an idea than most. Dr. Alexander Kumar has recently returned from spending 11 months living in some of the toughest conditions in the world. Along with 11 other men and one woman from Italy, France and Britain, he's been enduring the harsh winter at the Concordia Research Station in Antarctica. Cut off from the outside world, braving temperatures of 80 degrees below freezing, they didn't see the sun for 3 months. The aim was to simulate the conditions which might be faced by astronauts travelling to Mars. When he came to the Outlook studio, Alexander told me more about the members of the team.
I'm a junior doctor, and in fact I was the only doctor on the station. We had a nurse as well. Otherwise there were scientists, a cook, there were a couple of other technicians and mechanics.
And what were you testing? What were the pressures on the people who were there? What were the difficulties that you were trying to see whether you could cope with?
If you look at it from the outside, it's essentially taking a small group of people who don't know one another and, in fact, putting them through one of the worst winters in the world. The 9 months of complete isolation and that altered daylight cycle, that's what you would undergo on long-haul space travel as well. If you're going to go to Mars, it may take eight to 10 months, probably around nine, one way. Of course, then you'd have the problems of gravity. So, of course, we don't simulate zero gravity. However, the isolation and the psychology far outweighs the physiology in terms of the challenges and the area of study and the interest it invokes.
You said that you hardly knew each other. Had you met at all before you actually ended up on the ice?
We had a short training period together in Paris for 4 days.
And were you sizing each other up, thinking, I don't know if this person's going to get on my nerves or that person's driving me a bit nuts already?
I think we're all probably still trying to get our heads around the fact that we're going away for a year. In fact, to pack the mind for a year abroad is far, far harder than it is to pack, you know, for a week away in the Caribbean.
What did you take?
A toothbrush.
The first and most important piece of kit.
Well, I hear the astronauts on board ISS, the International Space Station, mended, did some repair with a plastic toothbrush there, so you never know.
Just describe the conditions in the winter there.
Well, inside the base, the conditions are much the same, but you realise it's a bit like flying in a spacecraft. You realise it's night outside when you pull up the shutter on, you know, your aircraft window, and it's dark outside. But imagine that goes on for 3 months. And even you're waking up to that continuously day after day. Going outside the station, in one step, you're changing 100 degrees Celsius. In just one step, going from plus 20 to minus 80 degrees below. And that's not including the wind chill. Our wind chill far exceeded minus 100 degrees.
Oh, my goodness. So what effect does that have on you when you step outside, even if you're wrapped up in the latest kind of thermal clothing?
The longer you spend, the higher the risk. So your corneas can freeze, the outer surfaces of your eye can freeze if you don't look after them. So everything is about prevention. You've got to really dress up almost as if you're going out on an EVA, like an astronaut outside of your spacecraft. You've got to zip up, cover each inch of your skin, and you've got to be aware that where you're stepping out into, anything can happen. And down there, whatever happens, happens. And as a junior doctor working down there, that was one of the most challenging things. You spend a couple of months trying to figure out, you know, this could happen, what would I do?
And if anything had gone wrong during that period, could you have been rescued?
No, I mean, not easily.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Now, no one really knows what it would be like to live on Mars, but our next guest has more of an idea than most. Dr. Alexander Kumar has recently returned from spending 11 months living in some of the toughest conditions in the world. Along with 11 other men and one woman from Italy, France and Britain, he's been enduring the harsh winter at the Concordia Research Station in Antarctica. Cut off from the outside world, braving temperatures of 80 degrees below freezing, they didn't see the sun for 3 months. The aim was to simulate the conditions which might be faced by astronauts travelling to Mars. When he came to the Outlook studio, Alexander told me more about the members of the team.
I'm a junior doctor, and in fact I was the only doctor on the station. We had a nurse as well. Otherwise there were scientists, a cook, there were a couple of other technicians and mechanics.
And what were you testing? What were the pressures on the people who were there? What were the difficulties that you were trying to see whether you could cope with?
If you look at it from the outside, it's essentially taking a small group of people who don't know one another and, in fact, putting them through one of the worst winters in the world. The 9 months of complete isolation and that altered daylight cycle, that's what you would undergo on long-haul space travel as well. If you're going to go to Mars, it may take eight to 10 months, probably around nine, one way. Of course, then you'd have the problems of gravity. So, of course, we don't simulate zero gravity. However, the isolation and the psychology far outweighs the physiology in terms of the challenges and the area of study and the interest it invokes.
You said that you hardly knew each other. Had you met at all before you actually ended up on the ice?
We had a short training period together in Paris for 4 days.
And were you sizing each other up, thinking, I don't know if this person's going to get on my nerves or that person's driving me a bit nuts already?
I think we're all probably still trying to get our heads around the fact that we were going away for a year. In fact, to pack the mind for a year abroad is far, far harder than it is to pack, you know, for a week away in the Caribbean.
What did you take?
A toothbrush.
The first and most important piece of kit.
Well, I hear the astronauts on board ISS, the International Space Station, mended, did some repair with a plastic toothbrush there, so never know.
Just describe the conditions in the winter there.
Well, inside the base, the conditions are much the same, but you realise it's a bit like flying in a spacecraft. You realise it's night outside when you pull up the shutter on, you know, your aircraft window, and it's dark outside. But imagine that goes on for 3 months. And even you're waking up to that continuously day after day. Going outside the station, in one step, you're changing 100 degrees Celsius. In just one step, going from plus 20 to minus 80 degrees below. And that's not including the wind chill. Our wind chill far exceeded minus 100 degrees.
Oh, my goodness. So what effect does that have on you when you step outside, even if you're wrapped up in the latest kind of thermal clothing?
The longer you spend, the higher the risk. So your corneas can freeze, the outer surfaces of your eye can freeze if you don't look after them. So everything is about prevention. You've got to really dress up almost as if you're going out on an EVA, like an astronaut outside of your spacecraft. You've got to zip up, cover each inch of your skin, and you've got to be aware that where you're stepping out into, anything can happen. And down there, whatever happens, happens. And as a junior doctor working down there, that was one of the most challenging things. You spend a couple of months trying to figure out, you know, this could happen, what would I do?
And if anything had gone wrong during that period, could you have been rescued?
No, I mean, not easily.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Sayida Warsi about a famous historic figure, Razia Sultana. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Baroness Varsi, whom have you chosen, and in a nutshell, why?
I've chosen Razia Sultana. She was born around 1205. She ruled around Delhi, in the Sultanate around Delhi. She was of Turkish origin. She was Muslim by faith. And she was an amazingly radical leader for her time. And this was a woman leading, including leading men into battle, 800 years before we had our own great female leader in the UK.
The facts as you describe them are quite astonishing. When did you first learn about her?
Well, I grew up on lots of stories that Dad told us about Islamic history, about the history of the Indian subcontinent.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in West Yorkshire, in Dewsbury.
Yeah.
And Dad would come back from the mills in the evening. We'd all sit down to dinner. Family dinner was always important. I was one of five girls. We don't have any brothers. And we grew up really in an environment where I think there was a sense, and possibly my parents felt, that they hadn't had their male child, their heir. And possibly we grew up feeling that somehow we weren't good enough. And I think Mum and Dad compensated for that feeling within the community by telling us stories about great leaders from the past, especially great women leaders. But I actually thought Razia, because she was described as a Turkish princess who ruled in India, I actually thought she was a fairy tale. It was about the same time as reading The Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen. So I actually thought this was just another fairy tale. It was one of a number of fairy tales which my parents told.
I suppose a lot of people who are not Muslims would imagine that in a Muslim household, a story of a woman leader taking a job of a man wouldn't be the kind of thing that a father would tell his daughter approvingly. Were your family different, or do we just have the wrong preconceptions?
I think there is a wrong preconception about Islamic history, not just within non-Muslim communities. The Muslim community, like many other communities, doesn't have a full and proper understanding of its own history, just like we don't necessarily in this country always have a full and proper understanding of our own history. And there are large parts of it which are forgotten, and much of it is very much current and maybe 20, 30 years from now. But I think, Dad did the equivalent of A-levels before he migrated from Pakistan to here to work. But he was an avid reader and was a great storyteller. And we grew up on a lot of stories about Islamic history.
Do you think he was trying to encourage you to have a sense of independence and of the possibilities as a woman in life?
He may have been doing, or he may just have been trying to make himself feel better and say, well, I may not have a male child, but actually yes, there are women who can do great things as well, and maybe one of these might turn out to be one of them. So whether he was making himself feel better, whether he was just simply passing on knowledge and information or stories, whether he just enjoyed telling stories, or whether he was trying to inspire us, I'm not sure, but something might have worked.
Before I bring in our expert witness, can you just try to picture for me the mental image that you had of Razia when you were a little girl? How did you picture her?
I imagined her in a fairy tale gown, possibly pink, with lots of jewellery on. And interestingly, I imagined her as being white, because I thought that's what princesses looked like, with blonde hair. So I think if I had to physically imagine Razia Sultana, she was probably the equivalent of what I saw in my fairy tale books. And I genuinely thought it was a fairy tale. I didn't think this was true until many, many years later, when I realised that so many of the stories that my father was telling me were factually correct.
I notice you call her Razia Sultana, but she liked to call herself Razia Sultan because she wanted to make it clear that she was a sultan rather than the consort of a sultan.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Baroness Varsi, whom have you chosen, and in a nutshell, why?
I've chosen Razia Sultana. She was born around 1205. She ruled around Delhi, in the Sultanate around Delhi. She was of Turkish origin. She was Muslim by faith. And she was an amazingly radical leader for her time. And this was a woman leading, including leading men into battle, 800 years before we had our own great female leader in the UK.
The facts as you describe them are quite astonishing. When did you first learn about her?
Well, I grew up on lots of stories that Dad told us about Islamic history, about the history of the Indian subcontinent.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in West Yorkshire, in Dewsbury.
Yeah.
And Dad would come back from the mills in the evening. We'd all sit down to dinner. Family dinner was always important. I was one of five girls. We don't have any brothers. And we grew up really in an environment where I think there was a sense, and possibly my parents felt, that they hadn't had their male child, their heir. And possibly we grew up feeling that somehow we weren't good enough. And I think Mum and Dad compensated for that feeling within the community by telling us stories about great leaders from the past, especially great women leaders. But I actually thought Razia, because she was described as a Turkish princess who ruled in India, I actually thought she was a fairy tale. It was about the same time as reading The Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen. So I actually thought this was just another fairy tale. It was one of a number of fairy tales which my parents told.
I suppose a lot of people who are not Muslims would imagine that in a Muslim household, a story of a woman leader taking a job of a man wouldn't be the kind of thing that a father would tell his daughter approvingly. Were your family different, or do we just have the wrong preconceptions?
I think there is a wrong preconception about Islamic history, not just within non-Muslim communities. The Muslim community, like many other communities, doesn't have a full and proper understanding of its own history, just like we don't necessarily in this country always have a full and proper understanding of our own history. And there are large parts of it which are forgotten, and much of it is very much current and maybe 20, 30 years from now. But I think, Dad was never, he did the equivalent of A-levels before he migrated from Pakistan to here to work. But he was an avid reader and was a great storyteller. And we grew up on a lot of stories about Islamic history.
Do you think he was trying to encourage you to have a sense of independence and of the possibilities as a woman in life?
He may have been doing, or he may just have been trying to make himself feel better and say, well, I may not have a male child, but actually yes, there are women who can do great things as well, and maybe one of these might turn out to be one of them. So whether he was making himself feel better, whether he was just simply passing on knowledge and information or stories, whether he just enjoyed telling stories, or whether he was trying to inspire us, I'm not sure, but something might have worked.
Before I bring in our expert witness, can you just try to picture for me the mental image that you had of Razia when you were a little girl? How did you picture her?
I imagined her in a fairy tale gown, possibly pink, with lots of jewellery on. And interestingly, I imagined her as being white, because I thought that's what princesses looked like, with blonde hair. So I think if I had to physically imagine Razia Sultana, she was probably the equivalent of what I saw in my fairy tale books. And I genuinely thought it was a fairy tale. I didn't think this was true until many, many years later, when I realised that so many of the stories that my father was telling me were factually correct.
I notice you call her Razia Sultana, but she liked to call herself Razia Sultan because she wanted to make it clear that she was a sultan rather than the consort of a sultan.
This is the end of Section B.
Končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo skupaj z ocenjevalnim obrazcem položite na rob mize.
Nasvidenje in srečno!